Morning, I'd invite you to open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 4. It's good to have so many visitors with us this morning. We've got some folks from Tennessee and Indiana and other Idaho and some other people that I probably haven't met yet. But it's a blessing that, and it's an encouragement to all of us that when you're away from your hometown, that you know that you don't kind of check out from worshiping God, that you know that wherever you go, you're somebody who puts God first, and it's encouragement that whenever we get folks that are traveling, Florida even, that when we get folks that are traveling from all these different places that come here and still care about worshiping God, you not only enrich our lives but our worship as we can all be gathered together and do these things together. As a note for tonight, we've got the junior high, high school, college age devotional is going to be at the Lawson's house. And so make sure that you get Wendy and Josh Lawson's address for tonight. And then starting tonight, now that we're done with the book of Acts on Sunday nights for preaching, we're going to be spending a few weeks going through some of the minor prophets. So tonight we're going to look at the totality of the book of Nahum. And then we're going to look at Zephaniah the next week, and I think Obadiah. And we'll look at some of those lesser-known books of the Old Testament. And then we're eventually, like I said, Lord willing, going to get into the book of James on Sunday nights. So Genesis chapter 4. This is a very famous story with Cain and Abel. And this really, in a lot of ways, shows the beginning of violence in the world. And if you turn on your news anytime, you'll see that there's always something going on that involves some kind of bloodshed or some kind of violence. And this is where it all begins. And so I want us to look at this very famous story of Genesis chapter 4 with Cain and Abel. And this is really the first story that shows what life in exile is all about. You'll remember in Genesis chapter 3, after Adam and Eve sinned, they brought curses on the world and they get evicted from the garden. Genesis chapter 4 shows you what life is like outside of the garden, what life is like exiled from the presence of God. There's a lot of lessons that we could pull from a story like this. We're going to look at this primarily from the angle of what it's teaching us about sin. But we'll go through this and talk about this. But we'll go ahead and read the text first. Let's look at Genesis chapter 4, verses 1 through 16. Now Adam knew his wife. Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, I have gotten a man with the help of the Lord. And again she bore his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, and Cain a worker of the ground. In the course of time, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, Why are you angry, and why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is contrary to you, but you must rule over it. Cain spoke to Abel his brother, and when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother, and Abel killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, Where is Abel your brother? He said, I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? And the Lord said, What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it shall no longer yield to you its strength. You shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth. Cain said to the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, you have driven me today away from the ground, and from your face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. Then the Lord said, Not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest any who found him should attack him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. When you think about the book of Genesis and even the word Genesis, there's a lot of English words that kind of come from that. One of them is genes. Like at the moment of conception, there's children in the womb and everything. They're packed suddenly with all of these genes that are going to work themselves out in the way that the kid looks, in the way that the kid maybe to some degree acts. I don't know. I don't know how scientifically proven that is. But like these genes are going to, in a lot of ways, affect what the kid is going to be like in the future, especially with how they look. In the book of Genesis, it's like the genes of the Bible, because there's so many things that we're introduced to, and there's so many densely packed stories that introduce us to so many different, like, genetics for the rest of the Bible. And if you try to think about the original audience of the book of Genesis, it would have been the Israelites who had just left Egypt, and they were on their way to the Promised Land. And so you think about what a book like Genesis would introduce to those people as the original audience. And one of the things that this book would introduce them to would be worship. This is the first story of worship in the Bible. You've got Cain and Abel both bringing their respective sacrifices to God. And this story shows us that God is not obligated to accept everything that somebody gives them. In other words, you've got Cain and his offering is not accepted by God. And just because somebody might claim or might do something in reference to giving something to God does not mean God's obligated to receive it. And so that would have been a very important lesson for the Israelites, because one of the problems throughout Old Testament history was the lack of appreciation that the Israelites had, and thus it affected their worship to God and how God would sometimes not accept it. So it introduces us to that concept. This story also introduces us to physical death. In Genesis chapter 2 and 3, Adam and Eve were told that if they eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they would die, separation from God. This is the first story where we actually read about physical death. In fact, Abel's name, if you look up in the Hebrew, Abel's name is Hebel. Like H-E-B-E-L, Hebel. And if you've, like, ever done a word search, that same word is the word that's used to describe vanity in the book of Ecclesiastes. Like, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Like, it's trying to strive after the wind where there's really no substance. Things are fleeting. They're always kind of elusive to us. And so Abel is kind of like that. He's kind of there, and then he's gone, and he's only mentioned four other times after this chapter in the New Testament. He's here, and then he's gone. And this shows us that life is a fleeting kind of life that we live in. Last night, when Samantha and I were going to bed, she's always joked, since I'm older than her, only by 3 years, though, so I don't know why she jokes this way, but she always jokes that I'm, like, getting old. And so when I'm getting closer and closer to 30, and she was making a big deal about that, and I'm getting more gray hair and stuff. And whenever I turned 25, she said, "You're in your mid-20s now." And she's 25 now, so I asked her last night, I said, "How does it feel that your life is over a quarter done now?" And she's like, "It's crazy that life is just that fleeting." And so this story introduces us to the concept of how fleeting our life can be and physical death. But this story also introduces us to the battle of the seeds. If you go back to Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, the chapter right before this, after Adam and Eve sin and God curses the world, he curses the serpent. And in chapter 3, verse 15, God says, "I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and her offspring." Here at the beginning of the Bible, we see that God is kind of projecting out, again, we see the genes of what's throughout the rest of the Bible, that there's going to be the offspring of the serpent. And there's going to be the offspring of the woman, which ultimately culminates in Christ. But throughout the rest of the Bible, from this point on, there's always going to be a battle between people who are true worshipers of God and people who aren't. And so in this story, you have Cain killing Abel, but think about all the other stories in Genesis even that show that theme. You've got Joseph with his brothers. Then you go to Egypt and you've got the battle of the Egyptians with the battle of the Israelites. And throughout the whole Old Testament, you've got this battle of the seeds, and it gets introduced to us in this story. Now, in this story, there might be something that's a little puzzling to us as we read this. How could the earth have been as populated as it seems to be? If you look, for example, at verse 14, the curse that God gives Cain, that he's going to be a wanderer on the earth. And then in verse 14, his complaint is that if I'm going to be a fugitive, somebody's going to find me and somebody's going to kill me. The story makes it seem as if the earth has been very populated up to this point, but Cain and Abel are the first two kids that we read about that Adam and Eve have. So how do we make sense of the fact that this story seems like the earth is very populated? In fact, if you go to verse 17 in chapter 4, Cain knew his wife. Well, where did he get his wife from? How did the earth get this populated? If you were to go back again to Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16, Genesis 3:16 says, "To the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children." I have an idea about that verse, and I could be wrong about it. But in order for that curse to make sense to Eve, would imply that she would have maybe had children before that curse happened. In other words, it's possible that Cain and Abel are not the actual first two children that they had, but they actually had children in the garden, and then the curse happens, so she can start to experience that curse as she's giving birth to more kids. So either way, it seems like Cain and Abel have had more kids. The story's not recording everything for us, and they were living long periods of time in this time period. And so in one way or another, they were able to populate the earth, and they had kids who had other kids and so on and so forth. But try to imagine what's happening in this story. After you have Adam and Eve sinning in the garden, that terrible chapter that happens, you've got life on the other side of the garden. And Adam and Eve, they have a child named Cain, and you can kind of see Eve's excitement about it, because she says, "With the Lord's help, I've gotten a child." The word the name Cain means gotten or acquired. And we're not told how long afterwards the next kid comes. There's actually some people that think Cain and Abel were twins, because it only mentions like conception one time in that section. But whatever the difference in age is, they've got another kid. And just try to imagine being Cain and Abel. Can you imagine your parents used to live in the Garden of Eden? I wonder if they ever told stories to their children about what life was like before sin entered the world. And so they grow up in this kind of environment. I wonder if they ever tried walking up to where the Garden of Eden was, where the giant angels were with the swords that would block them out. I wonder if they ever like tried to get as close to that as they could. I don't know what that would have been like. But one of the things that Samantha and I talk about as our kids get older is what are our children going to do for work? Well, in this story, you've got Cain, and he becomes like a worker of the ground. He's like a farmer. And Abel becomes a shepherd. He's taking care of the sheep, and so they're doing their respective different works. And I just have a question about these two brothers. Of the two, which of the two do you think was physically stronger? My guess would be that it would have been Cain. Because he's working on this ground that's now been cursed by God, that's going to bring forth thorns and thistles. So my guess is that he would have to do harder manual labor. Although both of them would be doing hard work. But the text says in verse 3, in the course of time. As if, like, many years passed, it seems to go, that life was like this. Like, life seems relatively normal. They're working, they're doing their job, the earth is getting populated. And one day, they both bring different sacrifices to God. Now, a lot of people have made a big deal about why Cain's sacrifice wasn't accepted by God, and I don't think it was because it wasn't an animal sacrifice. He worked the ground, so it would make sense that he would bring from the fruit of the ground. And Abel worked with sheep, so it would make sense that he would bring from the firstborn of his flock. And imagine this, like both of his brothers are bringing this sacrifice to God. And you've got Cain and Abel, and they're both going to this altar or whatever it was. And in one way or another, God communicates to Abel that I have regard for your offering. And in one way or another, he communicates to Cain that I don't have regard for your offering. How do you think God did that? Do you think he just kind of like went through the intercom and was like, I don't like what you just offered? I don't know what it would have been like. But in one way or another, it was communicated to them. And you can imagine Cain looking at Abel as they're offering those sacrifices. And Cain's face, you can just read it all over his face. He's implacably angry now. That his brother's sacrifice was accepted and his was rejected. You could say that he was not so much of a Jolly Rancher at that point, if you know about that candy. Yeah, that's funny. But like, you try to imagine, like, with his teeth kind of gritting against each other and this mean look on his face, God comes to him and says, Cain, if you do the right thing, you'll be accepted. Notice how God is extending out his hand in mercy to Cain, that even though you just brought a sacrifice to me that I am not accepting right now, I'm giving you another chance. If you do the right thing, you'll be okay, but sin's crouching like a tiger at the door, and you've got to learn to master over these desires that you're working through. Now that's God speaking to Cain, but Cain doesn't respond to God. Instead, if you look at verse 8, the text says that Cain spoke to Abel. Now, if you have the New American Standard Translation, it makes it seem like Cain actually just told Abel what God just told him. In other words, God just rebuked me about this, and they had this conversation about it. But some manuscripts add that Cain spoke to his brother Abel, saying, "Let's go into the field." I don't know if your version says that or not, but some manuscripts add that. Whether or not Cain said that, they end up in the field. Can you imagine this scene? Like, Cain comes up to his brother. He's like, "Hey, let's talk. I want to go out into the field with you." And as he walks a couple hundred yards, he kind of looks back at home base and can see that he's far enough, and he kind of looks around. And the text doesn't give us the details of what weapon he used, but I would imagine it would have been one of his farming tools. And he strikes his brother, premeditated murder, the first time that we read about that kind of thing happening in the Bible, killing his own brother. I don't know if you've ever watched like those criminal TV shows where they finally like do the "I got you" kind of thing, like the police officers like years later finally figure out what happened. Criminals always try to plan how they can get away with their crime. And so I don't know if like Cain buried his brother or not, but he went far enough into the field where he thought evidently like he was getting away with it. And then as he's walking back, you can imagine God suddenly talking to him, and he says, "Where is Abel, your brother?" Do you see God's grace again? He's allowing Cain an opportunity to repent. "Where is your brother?" And it's like Cain responds by saying, "He's a big boy. He can take care of himself. Am I supposed to watch over him all the time?" Kind of bucking his responsibility, sort of like his dad did in the earlier chapter. And so God just gets to the point, and he says in verse 10 to Cain, "What have you done?" You ever seen that like with kids, where kids think they're getting away from something with something? And the parent knows the whole time exactly what's happened. And eventually God just says, "What have you done?" You can imagine how uncomfortable Cain was getting at that point. And God makes it very clear that "I know what you've done, because the voice of your brother's blood is crying out from the ground. Cain, I know exactly what you've done. You're not getting away with the things that you think you're getting away with." By the way, anybody here this morning thinking that they're getting away with things that maybe like other people in this room don't know about? You think you're hiding anything? This story shows us in a very clear kind of way, God knows exactly all the things that we do, even when we think we're getting away with it. Have you noticed how this chapter is paralleling what happened in Genesis chapter 3? There's a sin that happens, and then there's people trying to hide the sin, and then God asks questions to Adam and Eve, and now he's asking a question to Cain. And in both stories, both people are trying to kind of abdicate their responsibility and say that they really haven't done anything. But God comes to Cain and he says, "There's going to be a curse. You know that ground that I cursed in Genesis chapter 3? It's going to be even worse for you, and you're going to be a wanderer on the earth." What do you think of what Cain says in verse 13? Like, as they're having this conversation, Cain says, "My punishment is too great to bear. I'm worried that as a wanderer, somebody's going to kill me. I won't have a place to settle down." What is Cain saying here? I think there's two options, actually. I think a lot of people will read this and they say, well, Cain is just kind of complaining about the consequences of sin, and he needs to learn to accept that there's consequences for sin. Maybe that's what he's doing. But there's another possibility of what he's doing when he says this. He could be telling God, "God, the punishment of me knowing that I killed my brother and me having to live the rest of my life with that on my conscience, that's just a great thing for me to bear. Like, that's hard for me." And it's possible that this is actually, to a degree, Cain's repentance. Because in the next story, he actually isn't a wanderer. And God tells Cain, "If anyone kills you, vengeance will be taken sevenfold." In other words, I'm going to take care of you. It's possible he's repenting. But it's possible that God is just showing grace to a sinner like he does with all of us. Now, when we look at this story, and Cain ends up going to the land of Nod, which is east of Eden, what does this tell us about sin? Because remember that this story is still kind of the beginning of the Bible, right after sin gets introduced to us, and this story has a way to picture sin that ought to make the hairs on the back of our neck like crawl and go up. Look at verse 7. When God comes to Cain, he describes sin as if it's crouching at the door. In other words, he's picturing sin as if it's like this lion that's making itself look really, really small so that you don't think it's a very big deal. Have you ever noticed this in your own life? This is how sin operates. You've got some kind of sin in your heart, and in your heart you try to convince yourself that it's not as big of a deal as you think it might be. It's hiding itself. You know, when you're driving and on your car, like on the rearview mirror, it says objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. The mirrors have to say that so that you don't make some kind of dumb mistake when you're driving. This is like what God is telling Cain. That thing that seems small in your life right now, that anger that you've got, that envy that you've got going on in your heart, it's a bigger deal than you think it is, and it's crouching. It's like this predator that's going to want to try to kill you. Can you try to think about this in our own life? Are there things in our life, sins in our life, that we've kind of convinced ourselves of that it's not that big of a deal? It's really smaller than it really seems, which really actually means that we're just becoming more self-deceived. Later on in the Old Testament history, God is going to rebuke the Israelites for their worship, which is, like I said earlier, introduced here. But Amos 5:21 and 22, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the peace offerings of your fatted animals, I will not look upon them. Can you imagine the Israelites going to the temple? And as they're going to the temple, maybe they're not giving God everything, but it's not that big of a deal because at least we're here. At least we're offering some kind of sacrifice to God. Don't miss this in the story of Cain and Abel. Cain is not the guy that's out there selling drugs. Cain is a worshiper of God. If Cain were alive today, I think he would be at a church worshiping. And Cain is, in fact, maybe better than some of us this morning because he came with something to give. How many people come to church just wanting to receive, 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 and never give anything? Cain's better than some of us. And God does not accept his sacrifice. Can we sometimes come here thinking, you know, it's not that big of a deal that I hadn't prepared to be here today? As long as I'm here, that's all that matters, and it is good that we're here. But we can sometimes think my attitude towards worshiping God. It's not that big of a deal. At least I'm here. And this story would warn us that things like that could be bigger deals than we sometimes realize. Think about how this would apply in our relationships to one another. 1 John 3:12, we should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. All right, why did Cain murder Abel? Because Abel was accepted by God, and Cain wasn't, and so Cain became jealous and envious. Can we sometimes think that the envy and jealousy that maybe we sometimes have for one another is really not that big of a deal? It's not really that important. It's just kind of like a small thing. At least I'm not acting out on it. Genesis chapter 4, with this picture of sin crouching, would show us that every single sin that we're harboring in our heart is a bigger deal than we think. Or think about even in our personal lives. Are there things that you consistently think about that you ought not be thinking about? And you convince yourself it's not that big of a deal because I'm not acting out on it. Here's God like telling Cain, be careful. It's a crouching tiger. Sin is serious and it's dangerous because it hides itself, but it also grows unexpectedly. Like in this story, we see this happening. After God kind of rebukes Cain in this kind of way, God tells Cain that sin's desire is for him in verse 7. Its desire is for you. It's like this predator that wants to take control over you. Do you know what happens with sin? Is that if we start to accept, like, sins over here in our life, like things that we think are kind of small, they have a way of kind of growing and overtaking everything about us. That's what God is telling Cain. Its desire is for you, and it's going to take you over. You've probably known people that have had cancer, but cancer can start really small, and initially you might think it's really not that big of a deal, but cancer has a way of metastasizing, like growing. And growing into parts of your body that you never thought it would have based on where it started. God's telling Cain, this cancer that you have in you, it's small right now, but it's going to get to a point where it takes you over. Have you ever noticed this in your own life, that sin ends up taking you places you never thought you would go? You end up doing things that you never thought you would do. Reminds me of 1 John 2:11. But whoever hates his brother is in the darkness and walks in the darkness and does not know where he is going because the darkness has blinded his eyes. We shut all the lights off in this room right now, and we didn't have the blinds that kind of let the light in. It was completely dark. And we all said, all right, service is over. Go to your cars now. How many of us would like bump into each other and stumble into each other? Here's what this is saying. If you're walking in the darkness, if you're allowing certain sins in your life, it's going to cause you to start doing things that you never thought you'd do because you're walking in the darkness. I bet, my guess is, none of you have ever woke up in the morning telling yourself, I want to have a really big fight with my family. Like, I want to have a big fight with my wife. I want to have a big fight with my kids. I just want to have a big fight today. Where do fights come from? James chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. What causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. Look at where fights come from. It starts from that little thing that you're desiring that you're not reigning under control. It starts with that little thing that you're starting to covet. And when you don't get the things you want, you lash out at people in order to try to get the things that you want. But you didn't wake up wanting to have a fight. But because you allowed those desires to stay in you, it's coming out in ways that you never thought it would come out. Try to think about how that would even apply just with lying. You say one lie, you never thought, you never realized how many more lies you'd have to start saying in order to cover up the initial one. You never realized how the ball would get rolling once you started that path of your life. This is what God is telling Cain. Cain, sin tries to make itself seem smaller than it really is, and you're self-deceived. And it's going to take your whole life over. But notice ultimately why sin is dangerous in verse 16. Cain is sent east. Throughout the book of Genesis, east is always the direction people go as man gets worse. They get evicted from the garden and they go east. After the Tower of Babel, they go east. In this story, Cain is going east and he's going to a land of Nod, which means wandering. You know, what's interesting is in the next story, he actually settles down in a city. He doesn't physically wander. But do you know what I think this means? It means, spiritually speaking, he's going to be a wanderer. That he's going to be somebody who is hopeless, he's restless, he's defeated the rest of his life because he's not going to serve God. Sin ultimately causes us to be cast away from the presence of God, which has to make us ask this question, well, how do we actually conquer it then? Like, how do, if sin is this dangerous and it can deceive me so easily, how is it that I actually start to defeat it in my life? If you look at verse 7, again, God tells Cain that he has to take his sin and he has to rule over it. That word for rule is masal in the Hebrew, and it means to master or to have dominion. Go over to Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. In Genesis 1:28, it says, "And God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" When God created Adam and Eve, he creates mankind. He creates them with this purpose that you're supposed to have dominion over the animals of the earth. And then in Genesis chapter 3, Eve listens to an animal of the earth, a serpent. In Genesis chapter 4, Cain listens to the animal that's become inside of him. When God creates Adam and Eve, he created human beings to have power, to have control. And the story of the Bible shows us that we don't even have control over ourselves. God's created you for something better than that. How many of us in this room keep getting defeated by sin? It's that crouching tiger that you're always telling people, well, it's smaller than it really is. You're making it into a bigger deal than it really is, which is what God is doing with Cain. He's showing Cain it's a bigger deal than you think it is. And you keep stumbling and you keep falling in these ways. God expected you to control those things. Okay, but how? How is it that we actually learn to control it? I think the answer is seen in the two ways that Cain and Abel both approach God. Both of them are worshipers, but the reason for their worship seems to be very different. When Cain approaches God and his sacrifice isn't accepted, did you notice how angry he got? Have you ever had a time before where you kept praying and praying and praying and praying and you started coming to church and things did not turn around the way that you wanted them to, so you became angry? God, why isn't my life turning around? Why aren't my circumstances being what I wanted them to be? Who is Cain worshiping? He's not worshiping God. It seems like he's just kind of getting his check mark, and then when things don't work out the way that he wants them to, he gets really angry about it. The thing that he adores is not God. Notice in this text that in Cain's offering, it just says he brought some of the fruit of the ground. With Abel, it specifies he brought the fat of the animal. He brought the firstborn. His heart is involved in it. Cain, I think, is looking to use God as a means to an end. Abel, we know from Hebrews 11, verse 4, by faith Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts, and through his faith, though he died, still speaks. You know what I think the difference is between the two worshipers? I think Abel adored God, and Abel loved God. And when you're filled with a love for God, you don't have time to be filled with sin. His passion was God. I'm going to say this, and this is going to sound kind of mean, but it's the truth. Do you want to know why some of us continually go back to certain sins and we keep allowing them to take us over? It's because we're not worshipers of God like we ought to be. If I was filled with joy over what God has done for me, if I loved God and I truly worshiped Him, I wouldn't be worshiping myself, which is why I keep going back to this crouching tiger. But if I fill my life with praise and worship of God, it blocks out all kinds of other things that I might do. And you know what's interesting about this story to me? Is that this is very early on in world history. And Cain and Abel know less about God than we know about him today. Abel knew less about God than we know about him today. And with the amount that he knew, he was somebody who worshiped God and loved him and offered his sacrifices out of that kind of heart. But ultimately, this story looks forward to what Jesus did. We just read this morning in John chapter 10 that Jesus was the good shepherd who laid down his own life. Abel was a shepherd, and his life was taken from him. And after Cain kills Abel, God is questioning Cain, like, please come back. We see God's grace permeating this story, but we have a greater idea and a greater understanding today of what God's grace is all about. And if that sacrifice that was ultimately made for us doesn't move us to worship God, then we're going to continually be succumbing to the tiger that's crouching at the door. You know, in this text, when Cain was losing the battle to sin, you notice this phrase that his countenance had fallen. I'm not going to suggest that everybody who has issues with, like, struggling with depression is in this category. But do you suppose a lot of the folks in our society that struggle with so-called depression, that one of the reasons for that actually is because they keep missing the mark with their sin? And it's getting them frustrated and sad and upset because they're not living up to what God created them to be. Have you ever been in that kind of place in your life where you keep sinning? And it keeps getting your countenance down and upset. And you get angry at yourself and you get angry at everybody else. And God's saying to Cain, if you do the right thing, you'll be accepted. Just start doing the right thing. Quit thinking that crouching tiger is smaller than it really is, because it's going to take you over. Is there anybody here this morning whose countenance is down? Analyze your life and ask yourself this question. Is it because there's things in my life that I think are small, that have started to metastasize, and they're taking my whole heart over? If you're here this morning and you need help, we're about to sing the song, The Great Physician, who can remove that cancer from us. If there's anything we can do for you this morning, please come forward while we stand and while we sing.